All right. Welcome, everybody. This is one of our Patreon-only episodes, something we try to do once a month, and we kind of put together ideas from these last two episodes that we've done. And so these last two that we did were on time and music, which have these really interesting connections to them. Like, the brain has this natural rhythm to it, right? It kind of breathes in a way, this kind of synchrony, these kind of set, these waves that you see on EEGs and things. And I think a lot of that is tied into how the brain then kind of couples to things in the outside world, how it entrains to things, how it kind of develops a sense of time and understanding kind of cause and effect relationships and all of those things. But I think that our perception of time then very much kind of influences the way we write music, the way we play music, the type of music that we actually enjoy listening to, right? Kind of falls into these sweet spots that our brain is kind of naturally in a rhythm for already. So really interesting stuff. We're going to talk about just kind of the things that really stood out to us as kind of profound and cool, and maybe kind of talk about how it applies to maybe us personally too.
Welcome to The Social Brain. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Taylor. And this is a show where we dive into how the brain works. If you've ever wondered what's going on inside your mind, even the things that you're not even aware of, then this is the place where we can unpack that and really explore it.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're right to like point out all these similarities between music and time. And it's like inescapable that there is a timing aspect to music and to producing music. And I feel like one of the things that stood out to me was when it comes to like time in the brain. I mean, we said this like many, many times in that episode, but that there isn't one single clock in the brain, that there's like this multitude of timing mechanisms in the brain. And I keep thinking about that. And it's like, that makes sense from a sort of academic perspective. But then on the other hand, it's like, why do we have this unified perception of time passing if we don't have one single clock? Like, what's binding that all together? That's something that's just in the interim has like struck me as interesting.
No, I think the binding problem really stuck out to me in general. And for people that don't know really what the binding problem is, like let's put it into perspective, right? There's 86 billion or more neurons in the human brain. That's like more stars than there are in the Milky Way galaxy. And then imagine all of those stars are connected to one another thousands of times, right? Like every single one of those neurons is connected to, on average, like thousands more, and even like way more when we're young. Like if you look at development, the brain when we're developing is super connected. I mean, some of these neurons have like 10,000 connections, and then that gets kind of pruned back as we get older. But the amount of synaptic connections in the brain is in the trillions, right? That's like more galaxies than we can see right now, all in our head, right? We have this inner universe. And these neurons, like Andrew was kind of hinting at, are operating in these different time scales. Some of these neurons care about things that are happening really quickly. Some of these things care about things that are happening over really long periods of time. And somehow in this like massive complexity, there's your experience, right? There's this unified thing. Like all of these, there's some neurons that are doing kind of perception of vision, and some that are doing perception of sound, and some that are doing this, and some that are doing that. And somehow, we don't know where, we don't know how, somehow all of that stuff is coming together for you to have the experience that you're having. And that's just like mind-blowing how that works. And honestly, I mean, kind of piggybacking on what you just said, Andrew, is that like the time episode in general, like blew my mind. Like I'd known like little bits of a lot of that stuff, but it was just like trying to unravel the complexity of that was just really cool.
Yeah, it was. And there was a lot of research we did just thinking about like the physics of time. I mean, neither of us are like physicists or mathematicians or philosophers or anything. So it was definitely on like a surface level. And it was something I had sort of like learned about when I was younger, but coming back to it and thinking about, there's these different ways of conceptualizing time in different fields. Yeah. Like, you know, neuroscience and psychology and biology more broadly, like we think of time, and pretty much most sciences, you know, like most sciences other than physics, probably all of them, we think about time as there's the past, there is the present, and there's the future, and we're moving, or, you know, we are kind of traversing a timeline in some way. Like, we're in the present, right? And the present is basically all that's real. The past has already happened. The future has yet to happen. And that's kind of like an intuitive sense of time, right? But in physics, there's like different ideas that have maybe better theoretical and maybe even empirical support to them, like the idea of like the 4D block universe, where everything has already happened and that everything that will happen has already happened. And so therefore, you know, we're living in this like block universe where time in the past, time is just as real as the present, is just as real as a time in the future. And, you know, you could, but then it's like, how do we square that with our experience of being, you know, these sort of present bound entities? It's like that got into my head. And I think we just agreed before that episode, we're not even going to touch that stuff. It's just too difficult to wrap your mind around.
And I mean, so much of the physics stuff, especially the theoretical stuff, doesn't really come into account until you're traveling at like 99.99 the speed of light, right? It's this interplay between speed and time. And something that I think was just fascinating to think about was that, like, the only reason that time travel would be possible is if the block universe was the true model, right? Because then the past is still real and it's something that I can actually go to. But like you said, Andrew, I think something that's been really hard for me to square is that it doesn't feel intuitive. It doesn't feel like what we're actually experiencing. We're experiencing these cause and effect relationships, these things that are flowing, that I see something happen and then something happens next, right? And there's also, I mean, we had a whole episode on free will that I've had some opinions about it, just in terms of kind of the way that I think about life, the way that I think about kind of cellular biology and all of these things. I think that we're making decisions. They may be really, really constrained decisions, but I think that there is a sense of will that allows us to navigate from right now to the next moment, right? And if this kind of block universe idea is real, then that means that free will is out the window. And I think that this episode in general was one that really kind of made me challenge and think through a lot of my free will ideas in general, because there's so much that's happening without us having any impact on it at all in terms of the way that our conscious experience is being constructed and displayed to us. Is something, like we said, we're seeing everything in the past. When you pick something up, that thing has been in your hand for 100 milliseconds at least before you even realize that you've picked it up. Like,
right. Yeah, no, I agree. I used to be such a like hard line determinist in thinking that free will doesn't exist. But as we went into that, this was like months ago, we had this episode on free will, and it struck me that like I just finished reading Kevin Mitchell's book, it's called Free Agents: How Evolution Gave Us Free Will. And to me, like, he makes some really great arguments about how biological systems have this sort of like inherent ability to decide. And so like there's a lot more to his argument than that. And he does touch on the physics too, where he's talking about like, there is kind of indeterminacy built into like the fabric of the universe when you look at the smallest level of matter, like quantum mechanics. And I think these are all like interesting arguments and great, but like, to me, it comes down to what is the observed reality? Like, people make decisions, and as an agent, like as a human being, I make decisions. And like, that may be a controversial, philosophical take, but I think you can't really ignore that. At the end of the day, some point you have to make a decision. And so it's just like sort of built into it. And I agree that the time stuff does sort of challenge that, but then I just think, well, okay, if this physics of time, and this is again going to be controversial, just doesn't fit with our experience whatsoever, seems like we're missing something in the picture.
Yeah.
Because if we can't integrate these sciences and our experience, then there's something wrong with our picture of reality.
So there's a researcher that we leaned on pretty heavily in the time episode. Bonomamo, I think is how you pronounce his name.
Yeah, Bonomamo.
But Yeah, he's got a book, Your Brain is a Time Machine, something like that. And he kind of brought up the exact point that Andrew was just talking about, in terms of there is this kind of neuroscientific, biological kind of reality that we're seeing through these scientific methods, in terms of how time is progressing, how time is perceived, how we kind of construct things based on the timing dynamics between these different systems in our brain, that doesn't seem to square with the physical, theoretical kind of stuff that's going on. And so there either needs to be some kind of new theory that encapsulates the both of them, or we need to somehow understand what we're missing in terms of the neuroscience to connect the two of these together. And one of the things that he brought up that like was really interesting that I've been kind of mulling over was that he said that neuroscientists are the only scientists that are studying the organ that's doing the studying. And so it's like, can something understand itself to an extent that allows us to really put a lot of these pieces together? And it's an interesting question.
Yeah. It reminds me of I think they're called the Mysterians or the Mysterions or something. They're the people who take the stance on consciousness that like, we might just be cognitively closed, cognitively incapable of understanding what consciousness is and how it arises from physical phenomena. And so that's why it's such a mystery to us. I think that's an interesting point of view. It's kind of definitely a tangent to what we're talking about here. But all this stuff is kind of big thinky, like deep think type of stuff. It all relates to each other in some way.
It does. And I mean, one of the, I think, ideas of creating these Patreon episodes is that it does give us a way to reflect on a lot of what we've done. I mean, we're preparing right now what episode 42 of this show. And so we've covered so many of these different topics, but we always cover them in these kind of niche areas. It's like, this is time, this is music, this is whatever. And this really allows us to start, even just for us, to start putting a lot of these pieces together. Because one of the funnest things about this journey, and I was kind of talking to Andrew about this earlier, is that this, especially from someone who like does like neuroscience, when you go into some kind of research field, you end up becoming really, really kind of isolated in a niche. It's like, I'm going to learn a lot about this really, really tiny thing. And because of that, there's not a lot of putting the pieces together with the other fields. And you end up seeing something that I've seen just doing this show is that there are these really strong ideas in my field, in social neuroscience, that the same brain region is then found in all of these other subdisciplines that never even get talked about in social neuroscience. Even though we're all looking at the same brain region, we're all talking about it as though it does different things, and nobody's kind of finding this thread that ties all of these things together. And, you know, one of the things about time is that it is so integral to all of these processes that we're talking about, right? It is underlying the entire perceptual process that leads to consciousness. And I think that's one of the reasons we're maybe kind of dwelling on some of these big topics, is because I think that time and consciousness are so intimately tied to one another, because there has to be this building process. And that's what we see in the brain, that we have this sensory stuff that's coming in. It's got to go through all of this filtering to identify specific features, to put ideas together, to a point where it gets into our mind, where we now have it embedded in all of these things, where we're not just seeing a scene, right? It's not just a bunch of textures and lines. There's a couch, and there's a chair, and there's a microphone, and there's a camera. And without even thinking about it, our brain has attached meaning to all of these things. But all of that has taken time for us to be able to navigate with all of these kind of filters and things working all in tandem with each other for us to be able to do meaningful things in the world.
Yeah, it all does tie together, because what you're just talking about, taking time. I've been thinking a lot about predictive processing in perception recently, because I've just been learning more about interoception, which is kind of like a pet interest of mine, just how the brain understands, you know, what's going on inside the body, and how that, especially how that relates to our emotional experiences. And predictive processing just in general is this, basically this idea that, you know, the perceptual brain regions, the brain sort of as a whole, is developing this model of the world, whether we're talking about the world that pertains to like your physical body, or, you know, the visual world, the auditory soundscape, all this kind of thing. And it's predicting what it thinks that's looks like, what it appears as, and then using, and then what sensory data is for correcting that model, for like, you know, informing that model of what is really going on here and correcting the errors that are made during that model building process. And it's something I was thinking about both in when we were talking about time, because David Eagleman makes this point about, you know, we're sort of living in the past. And I, the more I thought about that point, the more I thought, well, it is kind of like that, but it's like, we're not even really living in reality in some ways. Like we're just, we have this model that we're living inside of, and then we're using this data to correct that model. But we're, and in some ways it's kind of like we're living in the future because we're predicting what's going to happen next. And then we use the data that comes in to correct those predictions. So it's a weird interplay where time is absolutely a part of it. And it comes back to this binding problem and all of this, but it also gets to music, right? Because music has this inherent, predictive quality to it. We talked about like the EEG studies where you can see a signature on an EEG, an electroencephalogram. You can see the spike when somebody, when the music misses a beat, right? When you're expecting it to be there and it's not there. And the more surprising that is to you, the bigger that amplitude will be. And we're always doing this kind of prediction process. And if you don't think that's true, then just think about what I'm going to say, right? You're supposed to think I'm going to say next. I didn't do that sentence properly, but I don't think. But
no, you did. It got me. I thought the
good
word.
Okay. Nice.
No, and I mean, there's another, like, one of the quotes that I love from David Eagleman is that the brain doesn't see anything. It doesn't hear anything. It doesn't smell. It doesn't touch, right? The brain is locked away in this dark, cavernous skull, and all it gets are these neural and chemical impulses, and it's trying to make sense of these patterns, right? And so your reality is a construction. It's just all of these signals that they're turning the brain is turning those patterns into visual things and auditory things and meaning and all of this stuff. And I think one of the really interesting things that ties back to prediction, because I've been thinking a lot about this too, and something that was really interesting from the music episode was the really integral tie of movement to the predictive process. And this kind of came up in a lot of our time research too, in that a lot of our kind of perception, our ability to kind of link things up in our environment is that we're recognizing kind of cause and effect relationships. That when I move, when I interact with the world, when I pick something up, right, I am putting a motor action out and I'm getting some type of sensory feedback back. And I am trying to adjust, right, did I put the right motor action out? Because that sensory feedback is now telling me whether I did the right thing, right? And so when you look at like evolutionarily, like so much of evolution was around movement. It was around moving through the world. The whole evolution of the cerebellum was because animals started to get so big that they didn't know what was their own body moving and what was the outside world that was moving. And so they had to have something that like was able to predict their own movement. And when you look at beat perception, when you look at our ability as humans to predict when the next beat is going to happen, most of the prevalent theories around that are because we've linked music to movement, that we have this kind of this speech kind of moving our, we have to talk, we have to move things, right? That we've connected our auditory regions to the ability to then reproduce those things. And it's only because of that, that now we're able to like put sound out through motion and then predict what's going to happen next. And I think the thing that really ties a lot of that together for me is dopamine, right? Because dopamine is heavily tied into these predictive errors that Andrew was just talking about. Like when something really surprising happens, dopamine is what's like, whoa, like that should not have happened, right? We need to remember that. And it tags all of these things around that as being important for like this change that was unexpected, right? But dopamine primarily was a movement chemical, basal ganglia, Parkinson's disease. Like it is about movement. And so it's about like, I think a lot of this model that we're creating is a model of how we're going to achieve our goals moving through the world. And that all of our predictive processes are whether or not we're doing the right things to kind of get there. I don't know. That's kind of one of my pet theories, but
yeah, no, I think that's such a, I feel like we should just dive into that idea a little bit more. Like, why do we think, because I agree with you. I think that the brain largely evolved for movement, for like maybe a, even a more broad, a general way of saying that is it evolved to accomplish goals, right? More complex goals than what like an unthinking animal, a non unbrained animal can do, right? Because like you look at an individual cell, right? It is basically, it's very complex and very intricate and sophisticated and interesting. And you can spend your lifetime studying one single molecular process and
people do
not fully understand it, right? And yet a cell is really, compared to a whole multicellular organism, is a simple machine. In some ways, it's kind of stimulus and response. Like you can sort of predict what's going to happen with an individual cell. You really can't predict what a multicellular organism is going to do, especially not a human. You know, we have trillions of cells that are all working together in this complex dance. And so anyway, getting back to this idea, like why do you think that the brain evolved for movement, and why is that so fundamental to understanding these other processes?
I mean, I think this comes back to single cells, like you were just talking about, that the first cells that ever existed, probably it was just some kind of biochemical accident, right? There were these autocatalytic kind of reactions that were happening where it was able to recreate all of the things that it needed within the cell. But there became a point where the things that it needed were things that needed to be supplemented from the outside. That like this area that I was born in doesn't have those resources anymore. And now in order to get those resources, I have to move around the world to find them. And you see evidence like these early cells, like the neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin are ancient, are billions of years old. And they were used for a lot of these purposes of serotonin signaling what the nutrient state of the actual cell was. So do I have enough nutrients? Is there enough nutrient right here, right now for me to actually survive? And if serotonin got too low, then it was saying like, oh, my nutrient state is not good. And I need supplement. Dopamine, on the other hand, was the one that was signaling, okay, we need to move from this spot. We need to go out into the world. We need to kind of secure resources that are out there. And so it started these simple approach and stay type behaviors. Like I need to move or I need to conserve. And you see so much of that still like in the architecture of the brain as things got more complex. And I think it's just because it's something that kind of confines life in general, that we're constantly making these two decisions of whether or not I need to obtain more things to stay alive, or whether or not I need to kind of stay where I'm at. I need to rest. I need to digest. I need to grow and build, right? And when you look at that, the only reason we needed a brain was because we were moving, right? If I was just sitting there and I had just this constant resupply of nutrients and all of these kind of things, there would be no need for coordination of any type of activity between different kinds of cells, because all of those cells just have what they need. But as soon as I start moving, as soon as I have multiple cells that are involved in that movement, now I need coordination, right? Imagine two people in a canoe that are not coordinating with one another and trying to row to the other side of the river, right? You're going to end up spinning in circles, right? There has to be some kind of communication between them to allow that movement to actually happen in a coordinated way. And then that movement then, I mean, you were talking about interoception earlier, that movement becomes something that's internalized, right? Our GI tract moves, our heart moves, all of these contractions that need to be coordinated. Like it's all of this process of what do I need to do to ensure survival. There was this quote, I think it's from the Upanishads, and I'm going to like butcher it. This is not like, but it was basically this quote that said, the first things that ever came into existence were immediately afraid. I don't like the word afraid, tied into a lot of the things that we've talked about, fear and whether animals are actually experiencing fear. But what I do really like about that quote is that it distinguishes life as something that is trying to stay alive, that needs something to keep itself going, right? And it introduces the kind of hierarchy of needs that you need to move through the world to accomplish this life.
Hey guys, thank you so much for watching this episode of The Social Brain. If you're watching or hearing this right now, it means you're on the public feed. If you want to see the rest of this episode where we discuss more, go to our Patreon, go to patreon.com/thesocialbrain and sign up for, I think it's the premium tier where you'll get access to these episodes, but that'll all be detailed on patreon.com/thesocialbrain. Definitely check it out. We really appreciate any form of support, but we especially appreciate if you are able to contribute, and we show that appreciation by having these exclusive episodes. So definitely check it out if you're interested.